It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru...
Kaiser Soze!
No, that's Matthew Soze.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yeah.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Soze.
I want a party. I want a samba.
I want a samba.
You're allowed.
Got my new Maria Rita CD, and I am set.
Are you stoked?
I am stoked, and I'm even more stoked for next Tuesday and the release of the new Chayu album.
You're like 98% of all college men.
I know. See, it's like, it's really weird. I don't know why, but like, I get like really, really, really excited for like CD releases and like the Hunger Games, like movie releases and stuff now.
Right.
Yeah. Like, and, like this is never, I've never like been this excitable.
Excited.
I'm real excited to be a Jet.
Hello there, film lovers. If you're wondering what the hell was that, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. The show is available as a podcast. It's also, you can listen to it online. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you should log in at.
Filmsociology.tumblr.com.
Man who loves Brazilian and Latin jazz, just as much as he loves the idea of Tim Tebow being a Jet. My main man. Kobe Slagle.
Hello, hello.
And
you know what would be cool is if we had like a little like opt-out on HD1s, like, hey, you guys trying to tune into us? We're on the other station.
That would be nice.
That would be cool.
Since I heard a story about...
It could be a promo.
It could be a promo. There is a Film Sociology promo in the vault there.
Yeah.
I made it.
That's cool.
So we have to incorporate that a little more.
That'd be really cool.
Welcome to brainstorming on the air. A little later on in the show, we're going to be, I will be talking with musician Ted Drzdowski.
Who?
Ted Drzdowski. Shut up. He's one half of the band Scissormen, and Scissormen have a new live album and DVD. They're going to be playing next week at the Fourth Floor Blues Club in Richmond. They were recently at the Slippery Noodle, and they were also... at the Key Palace Theater, as well as Players Pub in Bloomington. But the reason why I'm having them on, not to confuse you with my other show, The Blues House Party, but there's a DVD directed by Robert Muggy, who is famous for the documentary Deep Blues, and the DVD features footage of Scissormen at the Key Palace Theater in Red Key, the Slippery Noodle here in Indianapolis, and on the streets of Richmond, Indiana.
Cool.
So we'll talk about that a little later on. And of course, we'll be talking with Kobe, the battle for his cinematic soul, and we'll talk about Into the Archives, where Kobe can say,
"Yeah, I'll burn it for like $5."
Right, but first, let's see what's opening this week. What has to follow the Hunger Games?
Julia Roberts.
Yeah, we'll get to her. We'll get to her in a little bit. I'm gonna get to her in a little bit. I'm gonna let her finish. But first, we have Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. That's the new film from Lasse Hallström with Ewan McGregor and Emily Blunt. Wait a minute. I can hear Mike Perry giggling. He is the Emily Blunt correspondent here at Film Sociology. And Wrath of the Titans.
Yeah. I don't know. I just can't get into it. Like, I didn't see The Clash of the Titans.
I did.
And...
not missing a damn thing.
I didn't think I was.
You didn't miss a damn thing the first time around when I saw it, and you weren't born yet, and you're not missing it now. So
have you seen this? Have you seen the new one?
Not screened for press.
Oh,
But,
probably a reason.
Well, there is a in the Non Nouveau, there's a review by a Wire review, I should say, by Roger Moore of the Orlando Sentinel. So take that for what it's worth. But we do have, I want to start with In Darkness, which is the Academy Award nominated foreign film from Poland. And it's, well, give it a listen.
Witaj, brate!
Jemu można było ufać.
Pojma.
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 Nieszczęsny, Żydy są takie same, jak my.
Słuchajcie, znam kanały lepiej jak własną kobietę.
Jaką?
500 kwitów dziennie.
Robota ciężka.
W zeszłym tygodniu pana żona nie miała jeszcze ani grosza.
Tu na grodach to wskaż Żyda. Tu poleży niezły pieniądz na tym robi.
Bóg mi za to wskaż.
Znalazłem Żydów! Żydzi! Znalazłem Żydów!
Od samego początku pod moim nosem ukrywasz Żydowa!
Zdradziłeś mnie!
Nastawiam życie swoje. Moje formuły w imię czego.
Ty wiesz, Wadama. To?
So in the film In Darkness deals with, it's obviously set during the Holocaust and World War II. We have a group of Jewish folks.
It's also foreign.
It is also foreign.
But you touched on that already.
Yes. I don't mind playing foreign film trailers here at Film Sociology. But it's a group of Jewish folks who have escaped the ghetto and they are living in a sewer. And they wind up living in the sewer of their town for over a year. And early on, they link up with a Polish gentleman who, not the most honorable, not the most reputable guy in the world, but helps them as far as making deals and getting them and for their paying them, he helps get them items and supplies so they can help survive and also move on when things get kind of hairy. Now, this sounds very similar to Schindler's List, obviously the Spielberg film from '93, and. One of the things that makes this film stand out compared to others, because I know some folks are not crazy about the Holocaust drama. It's not a date film. I understand that.
Yeah.
But this one really captures the claustrophobia of having to live down there. And let's see. How should I put it? When you're living in a sewer, it's kind of like, you know, living in a sewer, especially at the beginning, is like seeing a gun on the mantle in a play. You know, the gun will be fired by the end of the play. Well, if you're living in a sewer, something involving the sewer is going to happen. You just, and it just makes it even more uncomfortable to watch. It's really well made. It's, like I said, not a date film, but if you can get a good, strong Holocaust film, I think every year, every couple years for me, I don't mind that at all. We shouldn't forget this. But that aspect of it, of having to live down there and having to quickly move on a moment's notice, can be just as terrifying as those walking around the streets up on ground. So it's here, and this is one of the benefits of getting an Academy Award nomination, is that a film like this winds up getting screen time here in Indianapolis. So go check it out.
Now that was a good movie!
You mentioned Julia Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
She is in a new film called Mirror, Mirror, and it's not, it is the first, but there are two Snow White features, live action Snow White stories that are going to be put in the film. The other one involving Kristen Stewart and Charlize Theron. She has a name, not just title.
She's not named Twilight?
No, she's not named Twilight. You, of all people, with Twilight.
Yeah,
being linked to the Twilight correspondent of Film Sociology, mm-hmm. You should know that. Her name is Bella, come on. Because Fair Sweet Bianca sounds just like me.
That kind of sounds like something Emma might say. Has Emma seen these?
Twilight? She has no interest.
Really?
Yes, really.
Hmm.
She's got things to do. She's got a show, and she's reading. What's she reading right now? Narnia. So.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So she's. I think it's just she just got in under the Twilight radar.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I think it also helped that maybe, you know, Dad has made fun of Twilight for the last couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and then some of our friends have also made fun of Twilight.
Yeah.
So
that probably has something to do with it.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to be a parent. but Julia has a film, and it's called Mirror Mirror, and it's live action, and it's from the director of The Cell and the guy and Immortals, which it was a big hit last year, which even though it wasn't screened for the press, it happens. It happens sometimes. But give this a listen.
Once upon a time, in an enchanted kingdom, there was a beautiful princess. With skin as white as snow and hair as black as night.
La la la.
Her hair is not black, it's raven, and she's 18 years old, and her skin has never seen the sun, so of course it's good.
This spring.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest of them all?
Snow White.
What?
What?
Snow White.
Ugh.
A classic tale.
Do you want to hear it?
Gets a new wrinkle.
They're not wrinkles. They're just crinkles. Banish her to the woods. Is it done?
Just as you instructed.
I'm impressed. You're not as pathetic and wimpy as I have always believed.
That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
You're invited to discover.
The prince is rich. I'm going to marry him and then my financial problems will be solved.
An untold adventure.
Organize a ball. We are going to sweep this kid off his feet.
Of romance.
I think Snow White is the most beautiful woman in the whole world.
Agreed to disagree.
Mystery.
Who are you?
Snow White.
Snow who?
No way!
Power.
This doesn't fit.
Well, you
house.
Must have shrunk it, cinch me up.
I knew I was the same size.
And magic.
I'll use the love potion.
Puppy love. What am I supposed to do with a puppy?
You can rub my tummy.
Fetch!
Queen is getting married.
Take back your kingdom. I read so many stories where the prince saves the princess. It's time we change that ending.
You're with the bandits?
You're with the queen.
Should we help her?
She's doing pretty good on her own.
If you weren't trying to stab me right now, I might be tempted to kiss you.
The bandit's leader is a she.
Bandit's leader is Snow White.
Who feels like crashing a wedding?
Oh! Here I was having such a good day. Everyone has magic within them. Yes. I definitely have a happily ever after thing going on.
Mirror, mirror.
Anyone know how to break a spell?
Say hello to my little friend.
Yeah! Experience the untold adventures of Snow White.
You heard right, Kobe. You heard one of the dwarves quote Scarface.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
You
Scarface
know what? It's,
references.
It is not wall-to-wall pop culture references. It isn't. Thank goodness. There is the occasional one like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, a little backstory. There is, as I said, there are two Snow White movies coming out. June is Snow White and the Huntsman with Kristen Stewart.
Yes.
And Charlize Theron.
Mm-hmm.
Twilight. And
never mind.
Are you all right over there?
Yeah.
Can I continue off my review? All
yes,
right, thank
please.
You. Word has it was, you know, you have occasionally this happens. You have two films of similar stories coming out near the same time. There's Deep Impact and Armageddon. You have Tombstone and Wyatt Earp. And you have now this. And these two, I should say. And according to, well, I will credit Jeff Marker, my film critic buddy down south, who, according to him and according to whoever, that the Snow White and the Huntsman story is considerably darker by comparison. And what's fascinating is that the same director who made Mirror Mirror directed The Cell, the Jennifer Lopez serial killer film, and The Call, which is visually really impressive. I mean, very impressive camera work. And you see almost none of that in Mirror Mirror. There's a couple moments. There's one involving Julia Roberts every time she goes to the mirror and she walks through the mirror and it gets all liquid-like. Bill Walton would appreciate it.
Yeah.
And
that's kind of
trippy stuff.
Yeah.
And then she talking to her reflection, played by Julia Roberts, because you can do a split screen and whatnot because it's technology. Mm-hmm. Both of them probably want to party and samba. But it's interesting to see that this film decided to take a much lighter aspect to it. Watching this, and Brett Ratner produced this, so he's put a little bit of money behind this, so taking a break from the Academy Awards. It felt like if Julia Roberts were not in this film, this movie would have gone straight to cable. I mean, there's some familiar faces in it. Nathan Lane is in it, as is Mare Whittingham, and all of the Seven Dwarves you've seen in various times. If you did an IMDb search, like probably Kobe is right now, you've seen the dwarves in other films doing other dwarf-like things. Although, except Peter Dinklage, because he's in a series, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it reminded me a little bit from a visual standpoint of the straight to cable production of Once Upon a Mattress with Tracy Ullman and Carol Burnett. Lily Collins plays Snow White. Armie Hammer, who people know as the twins from Social Network,
the most masculine name ever.
A R M I E Hammer, that's him. And he was also J. Edgar's right hand man
in all sorts
of ways in J. Edgar. So, and he's good in this, but the main thing, the other reason why this feels like this film was made, it was made so Julia Roberts can announce that she's old. Well, as terrible as this sounds, she gets to play a villain, which I don't think she's ever done before, and two, she gets to acknowledge that she's not 20. She's probably a little older than me, rough, but no, she's probably mid-40s, if that, and this reminded me of, if you remember in Up in the Air, I always think of this moment. It's where Anna Kendrick and George Clooney are in the airport, and Kendrick is on the phone with her fiance, and he asks about Clooney's character, and she goes, "No, he's old." And he shoots a shot of himself in the mirror like, "Hey, wait a minute. I'm George Clooney. I'm the most handsome man alive. I'm not old." Well, this is kind of the female version of that with Julia playing the wicked stepmother. And when I told my wife this story, she thought, well, good for her. So she can still keep working with a 4 in her age, or a 5, or 6, or 7. Make note, people. So it's a harmless film. It's harmless. The dwarves have some fun stuff to do, and there's some cool visuals with their little springy legs that they springy stilts. I would have been intrigued to see what a darker version of this film looked like, but then probably less kids would be going to probably go out and see this.
Yeah. And you will get a darker version.
We will get a darker version in June. We'll see how that goes.
So there's that.
And Charlize Theron gets to be old and play a villain.
Mm-hmm.
So, and even, you know what, even the old age makeup for the one scene with Julia Roberts, still not bad. I am man, hear me oink. So,
This is kind of what I'm getting from it.
Yeah, it's not hella bad.
But a combination of...
Now that was a good
movie. It's in between there.
Yeah.
You know, if we gave out ratings, which we don't.
Mm-hmm.
We just give you weird verbal reactions. At least it wasn't...
I'm just saying, it's snoozable.
It's dumb.
Did you combine
this? It's awful. I don't even know what else to say. It's just awful. Don't be bothered by it.
At least it's not those.
Are those all on one track?
No, I'm.
You just hit.
See how fast I am.
You're a fast man, Kobe Slagle.
I know.
Okay, the other one that's coming out today, and again, when you win an Oscar, you get to be shown in Indianapolis, but that's the only benefit you get.
Yes, Indy, here we come.
Shut up. That's not what I meant. Partially, but this is the one that won Best Documentary. And you have to mention this because this is above the title, from executive producer Sean Combs.
No. Oh, yeah,
Undefeated.
I remember.
Undefeated.
Yeah.
So you're saying no to Sean, but yes to the film.
I'm saying no because I couldn't believe it, but then I remembered.
He's an entrepreneur.
The award. That's right, he is. The awards were the day after the All-Star game, and I was watching the dunk contest, and he had some corny, stupid thing he was doing with one of the guys where he like redid the Cedric Sabalos blindfold thing, and he was like promoting his movie and whatnot that nobody had heard of at that point.
No, actually, people had heard of it.
Oh, I hadn't heard of it. No, I'm speaking for people.
You're speaking for your people, the ones who hadn't seen or heard of Undefeated. And this is about a football, an underdog football team that is hitting hard times, and They got a hard-hitting coach, and they're going to teach these kids some hard-knucking football action. They like to play football on the football field.
Yeah, they do.
You notice no coach ever says that about any other sport.
Nope.
We like to play hockey in the hockey rink.
Nope.
We like to play baseball in the baseball diamond. We like to play basketball on the basketball court.
We like to bowl inside the bowling alley.
We like to cricket on the lawn. And we like to wrestle. We like to professionally wrestle in the squared circle. You never hear that.
No. Similar token, nobody ever says, like in football, oh, that was a great football move. That was a football play. He was making a football move. That was a basketball play.
You know what else to need? Momentum.
And the fire and the passion.
I'm sorry, what were we talking about? Yes, undefeated and other sports cliches. No, this is a film that follows the traits of the sports documentary. Is it Hoop Dreams? Not even close. But you have the troubled athlete that's very good. You have the hard-hitting coach that spends more time probably with his players than he does his family. At least he's not married to Sandra Bullock. and bringing home a lineman, by the way. But
that's on TV now.
The Blind Side?
This weekend it's going to be on TV.
You know why? Because it's a very important film.
Yeah, it's very important.
With Academy Award winner Sandra Bullock.
She's so great.
With her big hair and tight white pants.
She's so great.
Iron Man, hear me oink. Okay, back to the movie. So it's good. I could think of probably four or five other documentaries better than them. Oh, my gosh. But you get the football footage, which is always fun. You know, because you don't stage that. It just happens. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get to be a sucker for an underdog story like this one. So anyway, it won. It's in theaters, not just in Indianapolis. That's not the sole perk, smart aleck jerk.
Nice rhyme.
Yeah. So so go check that one out as well.
Oh, wait. Oh, crap. Oh, that's not the right thing.
No, he doesn't get tortured, and the beaver's not Jewish. So
okay.
However,
I'll see it anyway.
All right. However, that wasn't it either. There's no beavers or torture in Undefeated.
What do you want?
Now that was a good movie.
Jeez.
Why can't we just see them do cool stuff all the time? I'm in a movie. I have a limited amount of time. Be cool.
There you go.
All right. Let's take a break and restore order. Talk about what's new on DVD and Blu-ray, and we'll have my chat with Ted Drozdowski. Shut up. Up, Kobe. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
Any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs.
You know who I can do without? I can do without the people in the video store.
Which ones?
All of them.
What would you get for a 6-year-old boy who chronically wets his bed?
So, do you have any new movies in?
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
They never rent quality flicks. They always pick the most intellectually devoid movie on the racks.
Ooh, Navy SEALs!
It's like in order to join, they have to have an IQ less than their shoe size.
Let's just go. Just go open the video store.
Yeah, open the video store.
Blockbuster Video. Wow, what a difference.
Welcome back to Film Sociology. Going off the rails. Here
best part of the show. Best part of the show, Wesley Willis.
Okay. WFYIHC to the point, WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoci@WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, hanging out with Kobe Slagle.
Yep.
Very loose show with no guests. Well, I have a recorded interview, which we'll get to in a little bit, with Ted Drozdowski of Scissor Men.
Yes.
I'm just going to plow through the DVD Blu-ray titles because there's
some
anything
stuff. Cool?
Yeah, there's cool stuff. We have limited time. I'll tell you about them. Be cool. First off, the two of the big titles. One it just played in town like a month ago, but the David Cronenberg film A Dangerous Method. This is the one with Keira Knightley, Michael Fassbender, and Viggo Mortensen.
Mm-hmm.
The two guys play Freud and Jung, and they kind of battle for the psychological soul of one Keira Knightley. This is also known as the Keira Knightley Gets Spanked While Topless movie. Not as riveting as one would think.
No, kind of a bag of downers.
It is a bag of downers. It's very talky.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, it's from David Cronenberg.
It's very English talky, too.
And philosophy. English philosophy talky.
Talky, yes.
So find that section of the video store with Wesley. So not as riveting as The History of Violence or Eastern Promises, I assure you. Also on DVD this week is a film that was nominated for Best Picture and will always stun me that it did. And those who like the film think I'm a bad person for not liking Extremely Loud and Incredibly Manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
Max von Sydow got a nomination for this, and rightly so. He's quite good in it, but it's about a spaz kid. My words, not the film description. Who's
that's what it says on the box.
No, it doesn't. Whose father, played by Tom Hanks, is killed on 9/11, and his dad leaves him a clue, and his mother, played by Sandra Bullock, I'm sorry, Academy Award winner Sandra Bullock, lets the kid run all over New York City with this mute man, played by Max von Sydow, so he can go bother the United Colors of Benetton that is the people of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like it was cast with New Yorkers and real New Yorkers, real non-actors, except for those actors like Viola Davis and Jeffrey Wright, which, guess what, become an integral part of the plot. The kid's performance is so irritating, and I know he's supposed to be this precocious cynic kid who's smart beyond his years, running around New York with a tambourine. I'm not making this up. But it was just grating to watch him, and if I want to see a sad film about 9/11, I'll watch United 93, which was done years ago. All right, new titles, or old films being reissued on Blu-ray or DVD. Very excited. Got this. Can't wait to show it to the family.
Very excited.
Very excited.
Very excited.
I'm not Jet excited, but very
excited.
Exciting. I'm not Tebow excited. Nobody's Tebow
it's
excited.
It's real exciting.
Mystery Science Theater 3000, Volume 23.
Basement Dwellers.
Woo! And your host. In this collection, we have King Dinosaur, The Castle of Fu Manchu, Codename Diamond Head, and Last of the Wild Horses. Very cool. Also out on Blu-ray this week, the 70th anniversary of Casablanca, which
yes.
should have a, if it's the big colossal Blu-ray box set, then that has material that has not been released on DVD before, so check that out. Cashing in on Whitney Houston, The Bodyguard is reissued on Blu-ray. If you really want to watch that again, you don't need to. Dragonheart. Dragonheart, which is a very silly action film with Dennis Quaid and a dragon voiced by Sean Connery. And Julie Christie's in it, and that's always cool. A Night to Remember, the original. Corman's World, which I just bought on DVD, and I'm kind of mad because now it's out on Blu-ray. But a very cool documentary about filmmaker and producer and director Roger Corman, with some really good interviews by the likes of Ron Howard and John... I just had a blank. The guy who directed Gremlins. Joe Dante. Sorry. And as well as a really good interview. This doesn't have very casual interview with Jack Nicholson, who claimed that Corman kept him employed for about a decade. There's a brief moment with De Niro, and I wish it was longer. But anyway, if you're into B movies and cheap movies that are fun, then you should check out Corman's World. And then there's some Jerry Lewis titles. Who's Mining the Store? It's Only Money. The Criterion Collection has put out a box set, which these films are also available individually. David Lean directs Noel Coward, In Which We Serve, Blithe Spirit, This Happy Breed, and Brief Encounter. And finally, because I think he wanted this on Blu-ray, The Quest, 1920s fight tournament film, starring and directed by Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Mm.
Yeah, let's move on. All right, Ted Drozdowski is one half of the band Scissormen, a two-man blues group. And recently they were in Indianapolis at the Slippery Noodle. They were at the Key Palace Theater in Red Key last week. Saturday, April 7th, they're going to be at the Fourth Floor Blues Club in Richmond to promote their new DVD and CD. It's a live album called Big Shoes, Walking and Talking the Blues on the Viztone label. The DVD features footage of the band playing at the Key Palace Theater in Red Key, interviews with Charlie Noble, the long-past owner of the Key Palace, as well as interviews with Hal Yagi from the Slippery Noodle, and a tour of Richmond, Indiana, and the history of Gannett Records. So here's my conversation with Ted. So, Ted, give us a little history of Scissormen.
Well, you know, the band kind of started accidentally. I started traveling in North Mississippi in the early 90s, and I got excited about the music that I heard down there in the Hill Country and the Upper Delta. And I started trying to play that stuff myself a little bit. You know, I went from being a flat picker to a finger picker and trying to sort of get some of the patterns down and then try to expand it into my own thing. And after a while, when I started to do it, the drummer who I was playing with in my rock band at the time, the band was called the Devil Gods, the drummer Rob actually encouraged me for him and I to kind of put together a duo and start the Scissormen. So it kind of started accidentally. At the time, I was playing, I guess for want of a better term, alternative and classic rock in an original band. And then we ended up forming this as a side project. But the side project soon completely consumed the other band and all my time. And now it's not a side project anymore. It's a front project and a way of life.
I was wondering, what was your blues knowledge before Scissormen?
It was actually pretty darn large. I had been a music journalist for a long time, actually going back to the 70s, where I started as a part-timer in college, writing a music column for a newspaper in Connecticut. And I was just an avid music fan. Really, I mean, some of my earliest memories of television are music on television, like watching the Porter Wagoner show with Dolly Parton on it, and seeing the early Johnny Cash show and stuff like that. So I've always been a music fanatic. And one of the things I remember seeing in the 70s was a midnight special that had Ike and Tina Turner on it. And that was the thing that turned me on to blues. And from that, I kind of found out about Chuck Berry and then Eric Clapton, and then started tracing that back to Muddy Waters and Eddie Boyd and all those guys. So it was a circuitous path, but it was going in all directions. And it got supercharged in the 80s when, at the same time, I found this book called Deep Blues, written by the late, great music journalist Robert Palmer. And I read that book. Well, I read the first chapter, and I was so captivated that I literally went out and bought every single used LP, since at that time they were used LPs. You can get them for like $2 or $3 tops. As I read every chapter, I got every single LP in every chapter of that book. So it was like an intensive college course in blues. And at the same time, I saw Stevie Ray Vaughan play, and he was such a highly energetic and open-hearted performer that it completely galvanized me. So at that point, I became completely consumed by blues. Nonetheless, I really didn't think I could play it worth a damn at all. You know, I tried to play Chicago and Texas style, and that never really spoke to me. And it wasn't until I saw the movie that Robert Palmer and Robert Muggy made, Deep Blues, and then sought out the company of Junior Kimbrough and R.L. Burnside and Jesse May Hemphill, that I actually found that there was a blues that spoke to me and that I could speak to and contribute to, and that was kind of the Delta and Hill Country style that the band is based on.
Well, you mentioned the 80s, and I think a lot of people forget that MTV, for you know, and there's lots of punchlines about that channel, but I remember seeing videos by George Thorogood, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Eric Clapton, Robert Cray, and the Fabulous Thunderbirds, and that was a great opportunity to experience that music at that time.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, blues was on mainstream radio back then. Robert Cray had a huge hit with Smokin' Gun, and Stevie Ray was getting played on FM, and then you'd hear other guys getting snuck in a little bit more. And then really the 80s was kind of the last golden age of blues in America, and it sort of became curtailed with the death of Stevie Ray. He was sort of the pivotal and leading figure of that movement at the time. You know, pretty much after that, it slumped off. And I don't know, I hope we're seeing something of a revival now, but, you know, time and another, you know, time and some luck will reveal what the truth of that is.
Now, when you got to know R.L. and Junior and Jesse Mae Hemphill, now, was this before or after the Fat Possum resurgence?
It was right at about the earliest stage of it. There was just one Junior Kimbrough. Well, their first record they put out was a guy named John Weston, and that kind of slid into obscurity. And he wasn't as dynamic or unique as R.L. or Junior were. So when I heard their records, and actually it was just before those records came out, when I saw an advanced screening of the movie Deep Blues, I was completely captivated by that. I saw them play, and I thought, God, if these people exist today and they're playing that music in those places, I kind of need to get there, you know. And I'd already seen Jesse earlier. I saw her at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival once and was really captivated by her. But it was sort of at that point, and then I was kind of like into the thick of it with them as their, you know, stars rose as much as they did with Fat Possum.
Now, for those who don't know, Scissor Men is a two-person group. It's guitar and drums. So I got to ask, what's your opinion of groups like the Black Keys and the White Stripes?
You know, I like those groups perfectly fine. Well, to be honest, the White Stripes don't even register with me. I don't really care about them. Not that interested. I have one or two of their earlier records. It's okay. You know, Jack White writes cool riffs. Meg can't play drums. Sorry, people. You know, that's kind of my take on them. You know, the Black Keys, Dan Auerbach at least, comes out of a similar interest area that I do, and he really digs the sound of Junior Kimbrough especially. I don't really think he completely grasps how interesting, innovative, important, or generous a performer that R.L. Burnside was. I was talking to him a while ago, and he described Junior, and he described R.L. as just an entertainer. And I said, no, he wasn't. And I was completely prepared to debate with him, but we never really got into it any further than that. But he certainly loves Junior Kimbrough a lot. And Jesse, I don't really know how he feels about Jesse, but I would think he would find Jesse's work something he would be excited about as well. She was scrappy in a really good way.
Oh, indeed. And it's great because you on the new collection, Big Shoes, Walking and Talking the Blues, you have songs. You have a song called R.L. Burnside, and you have a song called Jesse Mae Hemphill, which I know you do in the styles of both of them. What did you learn from each of them as far as performing, either playing or performing for an audience?
Well, the great thing about R.L., I think I learned from him, was to be open to people. I also learned the importance of good finger picking from him. I mean, to my thinking, R.L. was like one of the best rhythm guitar players I've ever seen, and he had a fantastic finger picking style. And he also played slide in kind of a rhythmic fashion, which I enjoyed and I like to do as well. So I got those things from R.L. From Jesse and from R.L., it's hard to kind of quantify it, but I guess the idea is to, when you get on stage, to try to keep your spirit light and try to open your heart to other people, you know, because they always did that. And with Jessie, one of the most important things with her, I think, is to, like, keep things simple and fun and direct, you know, and just be as honest with your music as possible. That's the other thing, too. All three of those folks were completely honest performers. You know, there's not a shred of pretense about them. And it was that way off the stage, too. If they didn't like you, they'd tell you. You know, you didn't have to kind of, you wouldn't get mixed signals from Junior, R.L. or Jesse. It was pretty much a direct communication, whether they're on or off stage. And I guess that's when music is, to me, at its most exciting, when you're directly communicating with people and they're getting it and you know, communicating back to you.
Well, with Big Shoes, it's a live album as well as a DVD. Now, I wanted to ask, how did Indiana and some of the other venues get selected for this film and this recording?
Well, it's really strange, you know. If the location of the film and the recording was pretty much all up to Robert Muggy, you know, he and the director. He and I had become friends. We got to know each other years ago. We met in Boston for the first time when he was screening a Robert Johnson tribute film he made called Hellhounds on My Trail, and hit it off and stayed in touch. And then he moved to Mississippi and was working for Mississippi Public Television. My band was playing Mississippi a lot at the time, and he'd always come see us in Jackson, and we became friends. And then he got a gig as the in the film department at the Department of, I guess, Telecommunications in Ball State in Muncie, Indiana. And as it turned out, I was coming to play the Slippery Noodle for the first time, which is a place we were interested in getting into play for quite a while, just because it's a famous Old Lyme Blues Club, and those are the kind of joints we like to go to and explore. So he got our first Slippery Noodle gig, and I wrote him a note and invited him out to see us. And he said, yeah, that'd be great, you know, since it's only about 40 minutes away. And then a week later, he asked if perhaps it might be a cool idea to bring a film crew. And he could film a little 20-minute maybe video, and we could use it for promotion. And I thought, okay, great. Well, you know, then after that, he and I both discovered the Key Palace Theater in Red Key, where we also cut the live album during that filming. And Charlie Noble, now deceased, unfortunately, who was the owner and kind of visionary who put it together at the time, had just put out an appeal on YouTube. And I thought, well, you know, maybe we can bring a little attention to this place if we put it in the movie and, you know, kind of help it keep going a little bit, which I think we have. So then we added the Key Palace to the itinerary. And then Bob was aware of the great legacy of the Star Jeanette Records label, who we're actually playing a benefit for on April 7th up in Richmond, Indiana. And I had not, it had not really dawned on me that those, I mean, those records existed, but I hadn't really comprehended that they were made in Richmond, Indiana with, you know, guys like Lonnie Johnson and Charlie Patton recording. So then going up there and exploring got incorporated in the film, as well as some of the studio at Ball State. And then Bob thought it would be a great idea to put in a trip to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and we also set up a gig at the Beachland Ballroom. So it was really him who kind of kept motivating us. We thought we were just going to go up for one little show in Indiana and roll back, but it ended up being a week of dates up there in the bitter cold dead of winter. If it cracked 10 degrees that whole week, man, it was so miserably cold in February 2010 when we were there. There's a sequence in the film when we're shoveling snow off of an icon of Charlie Patton that's set in the sidewalk in Richmond, Indiana, and the snow's about 6 inches deep, and it's coming down more and more and more. And the only things we had in the car was a little plastic emergency shovel. It's got like a 2-foot handle and a brush for brushing off your windshield in the snow. So that's what we're using out there. And it was, I mean, honestly, if it was more than 10 or 12 degrees, I'd be surprised. It was so cold. We were freezing that day.
Well, I wanted to go back a little bit and talk about Charlie Noble. And you talk about another a straight shooter when it came to his club and his vision. He also didn't pull any punches. What do you remember most about Charlie?
Well, I liked his direct this. There's one sequence in the film when we're talking. Well, plus I just liked the idea that he decided he was going to build this thing. You know, Charlie's idea was, if I build this club from an old abandoned vaudeville theater in Red Key, Indiana, they will come. And sure enough, they did. You know, they're coming in lesser numbers these days, I think largely in part of the economy and a decline in popularity in blues. But for decades, you know, they did come out there. And Coco Taylor cut a live record there, you know. There's artifacts on the wall from a million Anson Funderburg shows and James Cotton and stuff like that. And the place is crazy. He just put a new roof on himself. Almost every inch of the area where the bar is covered with old record jackets and newspaper articles and albums and stuff. And it's just, it's definitely a testament to one man's love for the blues. What I remember about Charlie was just his honesty about everything, you know. Like at one point, when we were filming, at one point we're standing outside one of the cabins, and then he started to fall, and I grabbed him, and I sat him down in a chair. And the fall is cut out of the film, but in the next sequence he's sitting down in the chair, and he's talking about the golden years. And he goes, well, if anybody tells you about the golden years, it's a bunch of BS, you know. And he talks about how he'd been dealing with lymphoma and a whole bunch of other problems and stuff, but he was still kind of hanging on, you know, and trying to keep the Key Palace going. And I just love that dedication, that individuality, and that complete honesty, you know, that he exhibited right there. Honesty is a big thing with me, and that's one of the things I like about blues, you know. Blues is honest music. Like, rock and roll has its irony, you know, especially alternative rock and the punk scene, which I, you know, grew up as part of as well. But the thing about blues and the people who play it is they sincerely mean what they say, and they try to tell real stories, and they sincerely try to, you know, connect with people. And I love that about the blues. And that was something that was lovable about Charlie, too.
I think there was a story that that Leon Redbone said on The Tonight Show that it was his favorite venue to play at.
The Key Palace? That's fantastic.
Yeah. Now, were you able to, when you went to the Noodle, and in the DVD, you talk with Hal Yagi, the owner, were you able to take a tour of the entire place?
We were. We took a tour of the place, including the back where, I'm trying to remember which gang that, was it Dillinger's gang who used to, it was the Capone gang, wasn't it, when they were on hiatus. They would come down there and take target practice in the back. And I don't know, we didn't get to see any of the artifacts, if there are any, from when it was part of the Underground Railroad. But we did see a bunch of Hal's collection of blues artifacts that he has in the upstairs, which is pretty interesting. He's a pretty impassioned fan.
You've also done clinics at the Noodle, like and other places, Precia. What's the main thing that you try to tell people as far as playing, or what is the one thing that you're asked the most by up-and-comers?
You know, a lot of people are interested in, I mean, it's kind of technical, but a lot of people are interested in how to properly intonate with a slide. So that's kind of an important thing. And by newbies, too, they're also curious what slide is right for them. And that's important, and it's really an individual decision. You know, something thick might feel great on somebody's finger. I like a nice thin pinky slide, you know, made of either ceramic or metal material of some kind, you know, preferably steel if it's metal. But there's all sorts of, you know, approaches and things. And the other thing they wonder about is tuning, and I encourage folks to start playing in open tuning. I mean, most guitar players who are interested in slide and already play can play in standard tuning pretty well. And you can definitely play slide in standard, but to get a handle on the fundamentals, it's a lot easier to start in open and then work your way to standard. And if you're a blues fan and you like to listen to old country blues records, chances are, for the most part, you're listening to open tunings anyway. So it gets those sound in your head. You know, if you're listening to Robert Johnson and you're listening to Elmore James, you're hearing a lot of open A and open E and open D and open G, although with Elmore it's mostly just kind of open E and D. So, you know, I sort of talk to them about that stuff, too, and give them the history of it that extends beyond. You know, a lot of people say that the blues started in, I think it was like 1927, when W.C. Handy, the African-American composer from Memphis, heard a man playing slide guitar at the railroad depot in Tutwiler, Mississippi, while he was waiting. But the truth is, that sound that man was making with a knife and a guitar string goes all the way back to one-string violins from Africa, you know. So there's a really deep, rich transcontinental history there, and I try to convey an appreciation of that, too.
Who are some of your other favorite slide players?
Well, I loved R.L., especially. R.L. was, you know, my favorite slide player. Another guy is Sonny Chirac, mm-hmm. who is also a profound influence on me, and he's outside of the blues realm, but he was considered the father of free jazz in America, Sonny Chirac. Mm-hmm. Really great, great, great musician. Thought of sometimes as the John Coltrane of the guitar. I also love Sonny Landreth, Duane Allman. How can you not love Duane Allman? You know, beautiful, buttery slide tone. Clapton's a great slide player. I love Johnny Winter, you know, for his rawness.
Right.
Paul Rochelle, for a contemporary guy. Paul is just a wonderful national resonator player. Sunhouse, probably my favorite Delta Blues guy is Sunhouse, you know, and Robert Johnson. And I also love Rory Block. And Bonnie Raitt is a wicked slide player.
Yes, she is.
I don't think enough people talk about how great a slide player she is, but she's fantastic. And she has a really interesting approach, too. She keeps a slide on her, I believe, her index finger on her left hand, and then that frees up all three other fingers for fretting. I actually keep a slide on my pinky finger so I can use my three previous fingers for fretting, but I also use that pinky finger for fretting as well, because if it's a tight, small slide, which it is, I can press down individual single notes and use hammering and things like that.
Now, also in your live shows, you've also been known to use whatever objects are handy, especially when you come off the stage. And that's, for me, going off the stage and performing in the crowd, that's something that never, ever gets old when it comes to a live performance.
Well, I love it. And when I was a kid and I would go to shows and people would do that, it always just floored me, you know. It's sort of funny. The first guy I ever saw do it wasn't actually a blues guy. He was a Jimi Hendrix imitator named Randy Hansen from California. And he played in New Haven, Connecticut, and I caught him at a club called Toad's Place. And he came out, and he walked the bar and stood on tables, and I just thought, this is the coolest thing ever, you know? And, of course, I started playing during the alternative rock era, you know, mostly in the late, whoops, excuse me. I've got this sudden barking cough. I'll just...
get a lozenge for that.
That's Dolly the dog, the official Scissorman mascot.
Okay.
But, anyway... you know, I saw him play, and then as I went to see more blues guys, I saw more blues guys do it. Ronnie Earl, in particular, used to have a chord that was hundreds and hundreds of feet long. And Buddy and Junior, the first time I saw Buddy Guy and Junior Wells play, Buddy actually went out into the audience with a cable, went into the ladies' room and played, which was pretty hilarious. And then the place that I was in had a small second-floor balcony, and he went up on the balcony and hung over the balcony upside down by his knees while he played. And I thought, okay, this is way too cool. So that made a big impression on me. So as soon as I graduated from playing rock to blues, and even in my rock bands I would do that, you know, I just thought that I wanted to do that. Plus, it's just kind of part of literally getting closer to the audience. You know, it's kind of giving something special of yourself to the audience. You know, you're literally there with them. And to me, that kind of just kind of makes it a lot cooler.
Speaking of cool, when it comes to watching the film, when people go check it out, it's not a big crowd. And I think, especially if you're a rock band, you want something like Budokan or at the Fillmore or Madison Square Garden. But what has been captured has been you guys performing. No matter who it is, no matter where they are, no matter how many people are there, you still deliver a fine, fine live show.
Oh, thanks, Matthew. You know, I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, if we had actually planned to do a concert film, we probably would have done it somewhere where we have a stronger following, like Nashville or up north or down in Mississippi, and, you know, had a nice packed house on a weekend night or something. But, you know, since this was done where we had basically, I mean, you know, there was no budget for this film, you know. It was just Robert Muggy's imagination. So using students to handle a lot of the camera work under his close direction and a volunteer, Stan Sollers, who's an engineering instructor, audio engineering instructor from Ball State as well, you know, volunteering his time. Using those folks, we were able to put this thing together wherever we had access to the resources. And we had never been to any of those places we played before, you know, so they were all new territory to us. And it was also in the dead of winter. And, you know, but there is something I really like about it, you know, despite the fact that it's not our own little, you know, blues version of Budokan and we're playing to these spare audiences, is that's the way it often is for blues bands, you know. You're going to parts of the country you've never been through before. You're in the dead of winter. You're driving hours and hours in a van. And sometimes you get there and you're playing to 15 or 20 or 25 people, you know. And that's the way it is these days in blues, especially if you're not, you know, a big, super well-known entity like maybe a Joe Louis Walker or a Janova Magnus, you know, mm-hmm. or Tommy Castro. You're out there kind of slugging it out, doing onesies and twosies and one-night stands. And I kind of describe the whole film to people as part concert film, part road movie, part blues history, and part State of the Blues report. And I think that's an honest part of the State of the Blues report. You know, yep. A lot of people are out there working really, really hard to get a toehold in this genre now, where there are less people like you on radio than there were 10 or 15 years ago, less clubs than there were even 5 years ago, and way less record sales. You know, in the 80s, when Stevie and those guys were around, blues accounted for about 2% of the record market, and now it's less than 0.5%.
How often are you on the road nowadays?
About averaging out about 4 days a week, so, you know, pretty much half the month every month these days, you know. We're home for a couple of days and then out for like 4 day shots generally. And sometimes there's the 2 or 3 week stints. You know, we've got one of those. We've got a 2 week stint coming up in the Northeast at the end of April. And really, I guess the answer is as much as we possibly can be. You know, we're a completely self-contained unit. We book our own shows. We drive our own van. We do our own publicity for the most part, except for right now when we've got some great people working with us on this new release. So, you know, that keeps us more than busy. And I know a lot of other independent bands who are working a whole lot less than we are right now. So I'm really thankful for that.
And you don't have to be on the road 6 to 8 months in a row.
Yeah, we don't. You know, although if we had our druthers, we actually might hit it that hard, you know. It's not that we're not, you know, doing that, but all the bands that are in that position pretty much are affiliated with agencies, and we're actually looking for a booking agent right now. If anybody out there happens to be a booking agent and they're listening, and, you know, and we're getting a ton of airplay, and we actually sold out the first 3 orders that Amazon made on the CD in less than a week, so they obviously need to order more CDs. You know, a bunch of things are going well for us right now, so I'm very happy for that.
Okay, I'm curious. I have to know, how much blues is there in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
There is pretty much one modest wall of blues in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame right now. Occasionally, they'll have special exhibits, like you know, they'll have a Muddy Waters exhibit or a Buddy Guy exhibit or something like that. And you know, the Hendrix stuff, depending on how you count it, that could go toward blues, because at the bottom of his music, he was pretty much a Delta and Chicago blues man. Which is, you know, something that I always like to explain to people who are occasionally bewildered by the sounds that come from my guitar. You know, it's like, I ain't doing anything Jimi Hendrix didn't do, and that was 40 years ago, you know.
And you're still around, breathing.
Yeah, exactly. But they've got this one great wall and a few other things, and part, you see that wall in the film, and it's got Howlin' Wolf's suitcase, and it's got Elmore James's guitar. It's got a Muddy Waters guitar. There's a bunch of really cool stuff up there. So even though it's not necessarily huge, I know that Terry Stewart considers it like almost to be the heart of the collection. He feels that that's kind of the tributary that everything else comes from. And Terry's the president and CEO of the Hall of Fame. And just seems to me to be a really good guy with a deep interest in blues and R&B, man. He goes way back. He can talk about this stuff for days and days and days and days in a really good way.
Now, any word on a new studio album now that you have a live album that you're promoting?
Well, we've got about 18 songs written for a new studio album, and we're in the process of kind of promoting and living with this record for a while, and then we're going to, you know, try to figure out exactly what we're going to need to do to get that record done. You know, so we're also looking for another record. You know, we're looking for a record label deal so we can do this. This was independently financed. And, you know, we might try to knock on that same door again and see what happens. But, you know, if we could actually affiliate with a label, that would simplify things a little bit in terms of having to do less of the coordination for the campaign and things myself. I know this is awfully business talky stuff, but that's kind of where we're at. But we're really excited about a lot of the new songs that we're doing. And we've been playing a bunch of them on the road for a while now, too. Well, as I said, there's easily like 18 all-original songs that we have kind of sitting in the can in various states. We've demoed them. We've done different things with them. Others we're still kind of stretching out. And when it is time to go, we'll definitely be ready.
Is there anything else the audience should bring you? Groceries, food for the dog?
Well, I do like to play with just – I do like to challenge the audiences wherever I go. So if anyone's coming to the show up in Richmond on April 7th, if there's anything you think you would like to challenge me to play slide with, I would welcome it. You know, the only things I know for sure I can't play slide with are soft fruit and meat.
Okay, and it's a family show, so let's not go there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, for the first time, I actually picked a gnawed up rib bone off somebody's plate when we were at the Players Pub in Bloomington last week, and I did play with that as well.
How'd it go?
Oh, it went really well. Rib bones are good. You know, there's a real history of playing steak bones, too, a lot of the Delta guys used to do. In fact, Son Ford Thomas even recorded this album called Steak Bone Slide Guitar. And it wasn't just a name. It was a real steak bone that he played with.
And a way of life.
Yes, it was a way of life, not just a name.
That's Ted Drozdowski, one half of Scissor Men. And they're going to be at the Fourth Floor Blues Club in Richmond on April 7th. But you can also check out their DVD and CD called Big Shoes, Walking and Talking the Blues on Viztone Records, recorded live at the Key Palace Theater with footage from the Key Palace Theater and Charlie Noble, as well as Hal Yagi at the Noodle and, of course, Jeanette Records in Indianapolis. Hopefully I'll have Robert Muggy, the director of the film, on a little later on down the road. All right, a couple of notes before we get out of here. Rest in peace and RIP to Tonino Guerra, who is an Italian screenwriter who worked with the likes of Michelangelo Antonioni and La Ventura, as well as Blow Up, Zabriskie Point, Red Desert, The Mystery of Overwald. Also worked with Fellini on Ginger and Fred and The Ship Sails On and Armacord, as well as Vittorio De Sica with The Marriage of Italian Style. To my friend and colleague and friendly rival on the radio, but colleague in print and Nuvo, Chuck Workman, salute to you, sir. And I want to give an update on the documentary Bully, which was threatened with an R rating by the MPAA. The Weinstein Company now wants to take the film and get it unrated so it doesn't get hit with an R rating. And the day after that, a note from the Parents Television Council, fun bunch of people right there, basically asking theater owners to refuse to screen the film because, of regardless of intentions, sets a precedent that threatens to derail the entire rating system. Apparently, they're scared for their children about hearing bad words in a documentary that could help them when it comes to bullying in schools. Okay, enough talk about sequels to Anchorman and Twins. Apparently, there's going to be a sequel. Of course, there's no poster or no trailer, so I don't quite care, but I prefer this news over Twins or Anchorman. A sequel to Anvil, the story of Anvil. The documentary of everyone's favorite down-and-out Canadian heavy metal band, and this time they want to make Anvil 2 the quest for world peace by playing overseas. So hopefully that will happen. Okay, we got quick time for Into the Archive, where Kobe would say...
Yeah, I'll burn it for like $5.
And because of the Hunger Games last week and talking with Donald Sutherland, he also appeared in a film in 1976, which I had never seen before, called Fellini's Casanova. He plays Casanova. And it's 70s Fellini. It's visually over the top, and the sex scenes range from funny to disturbing to sad. This is not Heath Ledger romping from bed to bed like his Casanova a few years ago. Well, we're checking out. We love Donald Sutherland. Not that way. And here's some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Oh, I forgot. Kobe, you finally saw Hunger Games?
Finally. It came out last week. Saw it on Saturday night.
Yes, but you weren't able to report on it last week. So
it was awesome.
Was it wicked awesome?
It was wicked awesome.
And you read it.
Oh, yeah.
And you're happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we can move on. So until next week, go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
We go!
Salute, Chuck.